everyone. Thanks, everyone, for coming. This is awesome that all you came here. Yeah, I'll get introducing our first speaker. Our first presenter was not only the co-founder of the Illinois Secular Student Alliance, but is also the driving force behind Atheists, Humanists, Agnostics at UW-Madison, which is my group. He's a PhD student studying cellular and molecular biology, and he is currently working on the biofuel production in yeast. And he was also part of the team that created the first synthetic bacterial cell. He is the event organizer for Free Thought Fest, so none of you would be here if it was not for him. So I would like to present to you a familiar face, probably, Christopher Calvi.
Thanks, Mike. So I want to tell you some of my thoughts that surround the issues of morality at the beginning of human life, or if you prefer my alternate title, I got 99 embryos, but a person ate one. So I've got a thought experiment for you that I want to start with. So imagine that you're a doctor working at this beautiful fertility clinic. And as you can see, it's very tall, several stories, and you work on the top floor. And imagine that your building is divided into two different sections. On the east end, you've got the business end of the operation, all of the offices and cubicles, paperwork and copy machines and so on. And at the other end of the hallway, that's where all the scientific magic happens. It's where the laboratories are, where the clinic is, and where the medical procedures are performed. Microscopes, test tubes, you get the picture. So today there are 10 fertilized human embryos that you have in storage in the lab. And these 10 fertilized embryos all happen to be scheduled to be implanted tomorrow into 10 warm, welcoming uteruses. And for the sake of this experiment, let's say that you're confident that all of these procedures are going to work out flawlessly, and that all of these women are guaranteed to bear children. So given those conditions, some people might argue that those frozen blastocysts in your lab are people, or potential people. So let's say that you're at work one day minding your own business when suddenly a disaster strikes. The building is on fire. The flames are spreading rapidly, and you must take action. Down one end of the hallway, 10 of your colleagues are in the middle of a very important closed-door meeting. The smoke alarms aren't working. They don't know what's going on, and you realize that soon the fire will grow so big that these poor people will surely die in the blaze if you don't warn them. But then wait. At the other end of the hallway, what about the 10 frozen embryos that are waiting peacefully in your minus 80-degree freezer? They too must be rescued. Much to your horror, you realize that there's not enough time to save both. Smoke is rising, and time is of the essence. So who do you save? It's a real Sophie's choice, isn't it? So I'm going to make it a little bit easier on your conscience, and let's say that there are 100, or why not 1,000 embryos in that freezer. Would that change your decision? Let's make it even more ridiculously easy than that. Forget about the people in the office. Let's say that they jumped out of the window or something. How many of you would sooner go and save a dog at a PetSmart at the lower level of your office building than you would save those embryos? I, for one, would save the dogs, and I don't even like dogs. But according to certain pro-life viewpoints, human life begins at the moment of conception, and all human life is sacred. So therefore, those blastocysts are human beings in the fullest sense, the same as you and I. But yet Christians have a really hard time answering this thought experiment, because they've made a claim about the universe, which is that the life of a human embryo is equal to your life or to my life. And to that I say, Bullshit. This thought experiment is a direct test of that claim. And the fact that almost everyone would not go and save those embryos is proof that we place a lower moral value on them than we do on other kinds of human life. The question, though, is why? So let's review some of the properties of blastocysts that often lead people to think that they are worthy of our moral concern. Are they alive? Well, in the strict biological sense, yeah, I would say that they are alive. They have metabolism, they have homeostasis, they have cell division. Let's just forget about the semantic debate and let's say that they're alive. Are they human? Again, in the technical sense, if they contain the human genome, that's good enough for me. I think they're members of the human species. Are they unique? Sometimes people argue that genetic uniqueness is one property of embryos that make them distinct from the mother and make them valuable. And finally, the most strong and frequently used argument is the potential that they have to become fully grown people. And let's compare that to another kind of life. Skin cells that I grow in a petri dish in my lab. Surely, by my definition of live, these two are alive. And by the same definition with containing the human genome, I would say that they're human also in the same way that embryos are. Are they unique? Well, probably not, but let's say that in a few years with the tools of synthetic biology that one day I could introduce a few new chromosomes into these cells. Would they suddenly have more moral value just because they've created a never-before-seen arrangement of human DNA? Or what about identical twins? They're not less valuable because they have the same genome. Or what if I clone myself? I certainly don't want to do that, but if my clone were born, he would be a person just as much as I am, even though his genome would not be unique either. Maybe the only argument that I see any weight to on this slide is the potential argument. Of course, skin cells aren't going to become live human beings all on their own. Of course, unless you clone them. But what about this argument from potential? I think that leads to another point that is often overlooked in this discussion, which is that a human birth isn't inevitable after conception. In fact, it's far from it. Although the exact numbers are hard to gather for obvious reasons, the studies suggest that at a minimum, about two-thirds of all fertilized embryos will fail to implant after the moment of conception. And beyond that, you're still not out of the woods. Another third of those embryos that do implant will spontaneously abort. So if you do that math, and you even if you use conservative numbers, it works out to about 5 out of 8 fertilized embryos that aren't going to make it. They die. That's a majority. Forget about the problem of evil. I want to see someone try and explain this one away. The problem of implantation. Because this is a huge challenge to pro-life Christians. How could God allow this to happen? If embryos are people, then an astounding amount of death is occurring all around us all the time. All the mothers in this room are probably murderers. How could God be so callous and so sloppy with the design of human reproduction? One has to wonder, if God apparently has so little concern for the lives of these embryos, why should we care about them so much? I'm reminded of a quote from the great biologist J.B.S. Haldane, who, when observing the incredible diversity of insect species in the wild, he had the thought that if the Creator exists, he has an inordinate fondness for beetles. Well, I have a corollary quote to that, which is, if embryos are people, then God certainly seems to prefer their company in heaven. Of course, maybe they get to be adults in heaven. That's assuming they get into heaven at all. How do we know? When a woman gets her period, should we be baptizing that just in case? These are important questions that theologians need to start investigating. But back to the topic at hand. If blastocysts aren't worthy of our moral concern, as I argue, then the question becomes, when do you draw the line? So let's make a very scientific graph of the human life cycle of reproduction on the x-axis and on the y-axis, an axis of personhood, ranging from totally a person to definitely not a person. So there are definitely certain kinds of reproductive acts that definitely don't involve people. And there are certain stages in the human life cycle where most people can agree that it definitely is a person. But the problem is that no matter where you draw that line, whether it's at 3 months or 4 months or 5 months, or wherever you personally draw it, the line feels totally arbitrary. How could you say that on the first day of the fourth month, the fetus becomes a person, but on the last day, in the last hour of the third month before that, it's not a person at all? How can that transition into full personhood happen so abruptly? And how can you defend that position when really nothing is fundamentally different between those two embryos only a day apart? And this problem reminds me a lot of the story of Loki's wager. In Norse mythology, Loki was a trickster god. And one day he made a bet with some dwarves. And the condition of that bet was that if Loki were to lose, the dwarves were able to take his head as a prize. And sure enough, Loki does lose the bet. But when the dwarves come to collect their prize, don't mess with Grumpy, they get into an argument. Because although Loki admits that he lost the bet, and he admits that the dwarves totally have a full right to take his head, he insists that they have no right to take any part of his neck. And so they argue on and on about where to draw that line between when Loki's head ends and where his neck begins. And since they can't come to a consensus on when the head ends and the neck begins, Loki ends up keeping his neck and his head. So I think surely we can agree, though, that as you move further away from your face, you're slowly going from something which is definitely your head towards something which is definitely your neck. There seems to be some sort of continuum going on. And I think that's a pretty good analogy for the question of human life. So one way to solve the line problem at a first approximation is just admitting that in human development, embryos increase in value over time. I think that human development in the womb is obviously a continuum, and it should be treated that way morally. So let's take a look at what I mean by seeing the continuum of embryos developing. And as I show you these pictures, consider what properties you think it takes to make a fully formed human being and a person worthy of concern. Skipping already to week 3, there is already the development of a notochord, a primitive structure that leads to the spinal cord eventually. At week 4, there's a heart tube, which will actually start beating on its own. At week 5 is PZ's favorite pharyngeal stage, where a lot of significant rearrangement of the body plan is going on. At week 6, you can clearly see that there are limb buds, and most of the organs have begun to develop. At week 7, there are eyes and early structures of the brain have begun to form. Webbed hands and webbed feet are distinct. And by week 8, more of that lower brain anatomy is being built. And you've got eyes, you've got a beating heart, you've got all of the organs formed, or at least started to form. And this is all within the first trimester. It's all done, all of this, by week 8. So let's pause for a moment there. And I want you to consider whether you think this makes you uncomfortable about having an abortion at this stage. I won't ask you to raise your hand, but I wonder how many of you think that it would be immoral to end the life of an embryo that is this much developed. So just think for yourself, is this embryo worthy of your moral concern? And if you think it is, get out of here. It was a mouse the whole time. And if you thought those embryos were worthy of your moral concern, you better be a vegetarian. And I really think that you shouldn't be fooled by these pro-life arguments which highlight important sounding milestones in human development. Because the truth is that all animals, and definitely all mammals, go through the same developmental process. And if there's something valuable about a human embryo at such a primitive stage, it's hard to argue that we can't assign a similar value to other animal embryos. So PZ gets all the laughs for this one, but here's a pro-life billboard, and it says, "Face it, I had my eyes, ears, and a tongue at 28 days from conception." Well, that would be a more accurate billboard. In fact, I've got a challenge for you. We've got a little bit of a police lineup. All of these are animals. In the top row, they're all in the pharyngeal stage that I mentioned earlier. In the bottom row, it's the same animal at a somewhat later stage. And somewhere in this mix, there's a human, there's a chicken, there's a possum, and there's a bat and a cat. And if any of you feel like gambling later tonight, I will bet you $1 that you can't pick out the human from this lineup. So I'm often asked that if I think abortion is okay sometimes, where can I personally possibly draw a line? And here's a radical answer which I think will serve for most purposes. And here we go. If I look at it, and I'm not sure if it's a human or if it's a bat, then it's maybe not a person. That'll be my litmus test. And the graph that I showed earlier of increasing moral value over time might have been a little bit primitive, but to take a more serious approach, here I'm not only drawing a single line, but I'm taking a kind of a calculus approach and drawing a whole bunch of lines, each of which will take into account all the different variables and arguments that could come into effect in deciding whether or not an embryo is a person. So for example, I think there should be a pretty significant jump right around this period. This is about after 25 weeks of development, or 25 weeks after fertilization. And at this point, the fetus has its lungs developed enough that it's capable of performing gas exchange with the atmosphere. So this is bringing into account the concept of viability, the capacity for the fetus to possibly survive outside of the womb, with medical help, obviously. I think being viable on its own outside of the mother grants it some amount of moral worth. And I think there's another great leap in moral worth that happens around this peak here. And that's sometime between the 28th and 30th weeks, when the fetus will begin to have brain waves that are typical of adult humans. So this is the beginning of having the capacity to think. And I think if you ask me, the brain is really the most important thing to think about when considering which aspects make an embryo or a fetus a person. And also, it helps, this is where Carl Sagan personally drew his own line. But you can choose where on this graph you would draw your lines. They're color-coded, by the way, green, first trimester, orange, second trimester, red, third trimester. So you'll have to decide for yourself and do your own moral calculus to come to your own conclusions about when you think a fetus or an embryo becomes a person. And to conclude, I just want to review my presentation and summarize it into four quick questions that I find are pretty difficult for pro-life people to answer. So, you know, remember the thought experiment. Who would you save in that hypothetical burning fertility clinic? People, as in your adult coworkers? Or would you run to the minus 80 degree freezer and be seen fleeing the building with an armful of test tubes? Remember the problem of implantation. Why does God allow the death of so many innocent blastocysts? And again, if you can't tell if it's a bat or if it's a cat or a or a possum, then are you really sure it's a person? That I think is a reasonable question to ask yourself. And remember how to solve the line problem. You don't have to draw a single arbitrary line. Human development in the womb is a moral continuum, and we should treat it like that. Thank you, and I will be happy to answer any questions you have.
Hey everyone, if you want to do a Q&A, we'll start a line over here. Just you can come up, and then I'll have the microphone. Come up, yeah. And keep your questions concise and questions in the form of a question.
Hey, I missed my bus, so I missed the first part of your talk. But I thank you for what I thought was a really thoughtful, just intelligent presentation on embryo stuff. Here is what I tend to struggle with as someone speaking to pro-lifers. So if I am, say, 6 weeks pregnant and have a miscarriage, I want to have the emotional ability to say, I lost my baby, right? So when you argue that embryonic life has different stances, I'm pro-life all the way, but what do you say about emotional desires and their relationship to life?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think it's, you know, I'm taking my approach is, you know, 10 miles away thinking about this question.
Absolutely, and I approve of it, absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, I'll never know the experience of having a pregnancy and, like, what that is like to go with. But I think that, you know, the best answer to what you're getting at is, you know, even if you have a miscarriage in the first trimester, even though I don't think that's has a lot of moral worth, it doesn't mean that your own thoughts about what's going on inside you aren't different. You know, in your own mind, you built up this idea of being pregnant, and maybe you've, you know, bought nursery items and clothes and stuff, and so you have this plan that you're going to have a kid. So I totally understand that it would be, you know, devastating if you would have a miscarriage, even if it's early on. So yeah, I think on a personal level, I have no problem with you, you know, being upset by that. I wouldn't try to convince you that it's meaningless and you shouldn't be upset by it.
Or that it's not a baby. I mean, like at an emotional level, that I should be allowed to define it as an infant, even if not on a legal level. Is that?
Yeah, I think I would be fine with that. Like,
okay.
You know, once you take a pregnancy test and you know you're pregnant, then, you know, then you can say that you've got a baby on the way, okay, even if it's not a fetus at that point. In your mind, especially, you know that you're going to bring a child into the world, so it's very important to you, and I understand that.
Thank you so much. I'm not trying to attack you.
No,
it's something I struggle with.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi, my name's Carl. I actually wish Matt Dillahunty were here, because we just recently had an exchange like this. Is he here? Okay. We actually recently had an exchange very similar to this over email. I appreciate your methodology. I like to use that same sort of thing to, you know, challenge. So I kind of have a two-part question. The first part is, have you thought about extending that scale further to the right where you start incorporating development of brain functions into childhood? And then the second part of that question is, sooner or later there's got to be a law that says, okay, you can't kill this person, you know, So I think that's really where the big struggle is. So how would you propose kind of resolving that particular question? Thank you.
Yeah, so that's both great questions. So about the issue of moral worth after birth, some of you are probably familiar with Peter Singer, who he draws the line in a much further rightward position than I would. And, you know, he has been an advocate of thinking that infanticide can be morally acceptable, like you said, just based on the question of brain development. And obviously when an infant is born, it's still very dependent on its parents, and its brain is not fully developed. So if you consider, you know, if your definition of what's valuable about human life is, you know, the fully formed brain capable of, you know, self-reflection and thinking about its place in the universe and language and things like that, then maybe you could make a convincing argument that infants are not as valuable as a fully grown human. But I just really have a problem with Peter's approach with thinking that it might be okay to abort babies after they're born. And
to be clear, I probably push my line further to the left than probably a lot of people in this room, but the same thought process, but I think it's a good moral exercise. That's why I bring it up.
Yeah, I agree. And I might not be giving Peter Singer a fair shake. You know, you should ask him if you want to get good arguments from that. Then the other question you had about where to draw the line legally, you'll notice that I didn't go there because I don't want to go there. I'm not sure that my opinions are the ones that should be made into law. But you're right that legally speaking, you do have to draw some kinds of lines. And when you're thinking about Roe v. Wade, the line that they really chose was the one I mentioned about viability. And I think that's a pretty pragmatic approach, just because, you know, when it's not viable, it can't survive outside the womb, so you can bring in the arguments of bodily integrity for the woman and things like that. But after it can survive, then you can start saying that, well, you know, just take it out of you if you don't want it anymore, but don't kill it. But, I mean, the problem also with drawing a line, legally speaking, is that there's too many complexities in abortion. So, you know, you might say that abortion in the third trimester should be illegal, but you should recognize the fact that, what is it, like less than 1% of all abortions actually are performed in the third trimester. And whenever they are, it's due to health complications and, you know, the mother's life is at risk. And it's never an elective abortion in the third trimester. So, I mean, that's the tricky issue with laws, is trying to take into account all of the intricacies and situations that could be occurring.
I also enjoyed your presentation. I have a kind of a question about the viability issue then. I'm curious, you kind of briefly mentioned, you know, prenatal care or, you know, medical interventions. Mm-hmm. In your view, how is the idea of personhood going to be affected by, you know, perhaps more advanced medical interventions where you can have a fetus that couldn't, you know, wasn't viable, say, 5 years ago or even a year from now, but, you know, with an artificial womb or, you know, things like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. You're exactly right about that. That's the problem I have with the people who choose to draw one line, and they choose to draw that one line at viability, because that seems to be a really arbitrary place to draw it, because it's a moving goalpost, you know. 50 years ago, we didn't have the kind of incubator technology that we have today, so a lot of what we would consider, you know, viable or premature babies, you know, they just wouldn't survive at that point. And it seems like if you want to have a sound moral argument for when you should consider where human life begins, it seems troublesome to have it dependent so much on technology, like you said, that it's going to change. And 100 years from now, you know, we might have, you know, real synthetic wombs where you could grow a blastocyst in an artificial womb. And would that make all abortions then illegal? It's a tricky subject for those who want to use viability. I think I'm actually out of time, so I'm going to kick myself off stage. And thanks for listening.